And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alan Eisenberg. This is the Alan Eisenberg Show. We're back again with our weekly Sunday night edition right here on WRJN, AM 1400 News Talk for Racine and Kenosha and parts of Milwaukee and Northern Illinois. Good to be back. Well, another interesting Sunday night. Our guest this evening is Will Tuttle. Dr. Will Tuttle. A very interesting man, to say the least. And a difficult topic, and I'll explain why I'm saying that. He wrote a book recently called The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. And to you I say, good evening, Dr. Will Tuttle.
Good evening, Alan. It's great to be on your show.
How are you tonight?
I'm doing wonderfully, thanks.
Now, it's my understanding, and I guess it gets my attention because your book is called The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. I had my protege, or my accomplice, depending on how you look at it, look up reviews of the book, The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. And he said that 18 reviewers on Yahoo gave the book 5 stars, one gave it 4 stars, and one interesting comment, at least that I found interesting, was it's not going to convert meat eaters. And I'm going to tell you why I'm starting the show not only talking about the book, but talking about that comment. I have a friend who frequently comes up with ideas for the show. I take off on a lot of ideas from a lot of different people. Everything that comes across my desk, I contemplate. I probably do 20, 30 authors a year. Some are authors of books that are self-published, Vanity Press. Some are authors of New York Times bestseller books. I like talking to authors. I like talking to, and I like this topic. And to tell you the truth, I've probably done in recent years about 10 authors with books with similar themes. And I would also concede none of them as good as yours. I concede yours is the best. However, and it's a good read. It's, you're really encyclopedic. Of all the books on this topic, yours is the best researched, the best annotated. You're the only one that has a bibliography like yours. There's nothing even comparable. The book really is almost a textbook. Is it being used as a textbook anywhere?
It is beginning to be used as a textbook in formal classes that are springing up around the United States, and it's starting now to be being introduced possibly as a textbook for college courses as well, and I really think you're right. It would be perfect for that. It's just still pretty new, so I'm hoping, and the subject also is not exactly what a lot of college courses are about, but I think it could be and it should be.
Now, I'm going to tell you two spokespersons or advocates that spring to mind. One is Arthur Poletti. And Arthur Poletti wrote a book, God Does Not Eat Meat. which I thought was interesting as heck. It was self-published. The book is doing well. And he went on a lecture circuit, and he actually got, and this didn't surprise me, he got lambasted in a lot of places that he went. I love his little book, God Does Not Eat Meat. As a matter of fact, some people insisted when he went on his lecture tour, when he got to the talkback part, that Jesus Christ was absolutely carnivorous. What do you say about that?
Well, I don't think we'll ever know. I mean, there's no really way to know. We don't have any videotapes or anything.
Well, it's people who relied on quotes from the Bible.
Right. But the Bible has been edited many times by many people for many reasons. And I think there's a good chance that he was what we would call today a vegetarian or a vegan based on some of the research. That's, I think, this book by Keith Akers that I talk about in my book, I think he did a lot of very excellent book. He wrote a book called The Lost Religion of Jesus, in which he consulted really the very earliest writings that we have by people who were writing about Christians way back in the first and second century, and they basically all agree that whether they hated the Christians or loved the Christians or whatever, the early ones, that they didn't eat meat. None of them ate meat. They were known for that. They were famous for not eating meat. That was well known, and especially among the inner core, the disciples, Peter and James especially. And he makes the argument that it was the later disciples, or apostles like Paul and Bartholomew, that actually were meat eaters and never got that teaching, never wanted that teaching, and brought what became Christianity into a whole another direction. And that was really especially sealed when a few hundred years later, when the Emperor Constantine decided he wanted to make Christianity the state religion of Rome. They had these people called correctores that went through and corrected corrected the text. When they were putting together the books that would be in the Bible, and they got rid of any references to the not eating meat, and perhaps very well could have put in him eating meat. For example, the famous story of the loaves and the fishes, there's a lot of evidence that it was loaves and fruits or something like that, not fish. And there's a lot of reasons why fish sounds kind of fishy in that story. But so we don't really know, and based on other evidence as well, that he could have possibly been affiliated with the Essenes. Very many of the Essene groups or subgroups were also what we would call vegetarians. They were eating primarily a plant-based diet. And so I think you could make a strong case that Jesus didn't eat meat, but I don't think you could ever prove it definitively. But there's a lot of evidence that he was that way.
Now, my suspicion for a long time now has been that if Jesus was a vegetarian, it was purely for ideological reasons.
Right.
He didn't like the idea. My reading of the Bible tells me that he didn't like the idea of taking life. He was a giver of life.
Exactly.
But that's got nothing to do with health.
Right.
And it's got nothing to do with, I don't believe that somebody 2,000 years ago had a global view of a peace diet.
Well, I think he did have a global view of humanity's predicament in the sense that our violence, comes back to us. And I think he was a man of compassion more than anything. He shows compassion over and over again and mercy and kindness, especially for those who are vulnerable. And he talks a lot about animals. He talks about how he would love to just gather Jerusalem under his wings as a mother hen does for her chicks and protect people. And I think the fact that he uses metaphors of animals quite often, the lilies of the field and the, you know, the birds and so forth, that he was very connected to nature and would be a person who would show kindness and compassion to all life, and not only to poor people and so forth, and to, you know, prostitutes and all that, but to, you know, those who are systematically abused and who have feelings, who are capable of feeling pain. I think he would for sure be a good, you know, a person to give that teaching, and he wouldn't be the only one. I mean, if you look at other great religious teachers that are admired in other traditions, typically they all had the same sensibilities. They encouraged their followers and students to be kind and compassionate. And, you know, one thinks of Mahavira, the founder of the Jain tradition, or the Buddha, the founder of the Buddhist tradition, or many of the great teachers in the other religions were the same way. So it wouldn't just be him alone. And especially if you look at that scene of the money changers in the temple, back in that day, the temple was more like a slaughterhouse. It was where animals were taken to be killed, birds,
pigeons. For sacrifice.
For sacrifice, right, for sacrifice. And so this was how the power structure at the time, the rabbis who were running the whole thing, made their money. And I think that one could read it, and many, you know, some scholars do, that he was infuriated, not that they were making money on this, but that they were, you know, turning this place of worship into such a bloodbath and so much violence and brutality, and that was why he overturned the tables, which I think is very interesting and, in a sense, more characteristic of him
now,
as a teacher.
You yourself, first I have to explain something. We have here what brought this show to me was the book. And it's a 318-page book. And to try to do a one-hour show about a 318-page encyclopedic book is literally, virtually impossible. The idea is ridiculous in its inception. It's just a ridiculous idea.
I appreciate you saying that.
Yes. And yet, the book is a must-read. And I will tell you something else, folks. It's going to help if you're an educated person. I think the book is it's highbrow. The book is highbrow. It's a lot of references to medical concepts, public health concepts. Man, you are all over the place. Now, let's instead try to deal with the main concepts that you stand for and that you advocate for. First of all, are you, at this time in your life, a Christian?
Well, I believe that the way the word Christian is usually defined, I mean, the way the word Christian is defined actually in the Webster's dictionary is someone who aspires to following the teachings of Jesus Christ, then yes, I would say that I am a Christian, because I really love the teachings that he brought to us. And there are so many different branches of Christianity that it's difficult, you know, to say that I'm, for example, a fundamentalist Christian. I would say, no, I'm not a fundamentalist Christian. But I speak pretty much every single Sunday at a church on Sunday morning. I travel. My
a sermon?
Actually, I give the sermon on Sunday morning at more what we call, I guess, progressive churches, like either Unity churches or Unitarian churches or some, you know, independent churches. So my training, my religious or spiritual training, a lot of it is in the Eastern traditions, especially Buddhist traditions. But I've spent a lot of...
You trained as a Zen Buddhist monk.
Right. I trained as a Zen Buddhist monk, so I shaved my head and wore robes and lived in a monastery in Korea back in the 1980s.
I would kill to have a head of hair like you have.
It all grew back.
As a matter of fact, it'd be very nice if I could get your wife to save your clippings so I could paste them on the top of my head. I'm not doing too good in the hair department these days. How old are you, by the way?
I was born in 1953, so whatever that is, 50.
Oh, come on, man. I got to do the math, too?
54.
Okay. Just kidding. Now, I've got a friend, and by the way, I think I'm on the same page with you from a religious standpoint. So this, we're copacetic, as they say.
Right.
Eating for spiritual health. What has eating has everything to do with health? Oh, by the way, Will Tuttle's wife's name is Madeline. And Madeline prepared a list of meals that that came from the publicist with my copy of the book. I want you to know, Dr. Tuttle, if I ate that diet, I'd be dead in about a month.
Why would you be dead?
Oh, I was praying that you would ask me why.
Yeah.
Because it's a vegetarian, vegan diet, but I'm a diabetic. And it's loaded with starch and sugars. And I'm not an insulin diabetic. I'm a medicated diabetic. And it is loaded with stuff that would kill me. It's loaded, 50% of what's in there, I can't eat. I can't even eat fruit.
Oh, I see.
Right. Yep. So I need to get Madeline going on that one. Now, you travel all over the country, right?
Yes, right.
Do you get to the Midwest? Have you been in Wisconsin?
Yeah. We get through the Midwest usually every year or two. We live in a rolling home, an RV. And we were in Madison, Wisconsin, I think, in September.
Okay. Well, this is a big hunting state. It's one of the biggest hunting states in the entire country. They issue, like, I don't know, 1,600,000, 800,000 hunting licenses every year.
Right.
It's a big hunting and fishing state. And we got gun nuts. Oh, there go the phones. Just kidding. We have gun nuts running all over the place, killing animals. And I have a close friend who says, who wants me to do a show like this, talking to an expert like you. But the question raised is, and it's the question that some reviewers of the book raise, and they say, I swear to God, I've been waiting all week to put this to you, because I am on the same page with you. I agree with everything in your book, and it was very refreshing.
Wow.
But the $64 million question is, where are we on changing attitudes in society? Are we getting anywhere? Are we really getting anywhere? The meat industry gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Chickens, fish, beef. Are we really getting anywhere, or are we just a bunch of, are we tilting at the windmills?
You're right. That is the $64 million question. And, I feel that I'm doing, all that I can to make a transformation in this culture so that we don't kill each other off and kill everybody else off, and we have some kind of a world to leave for our children. But the as I talk about in the book, the momentum of this culture is deeply ingrained. We've got 10,000 years of a culture that at the deepest level we've learned to look at beings merely as things and to eat that way, to behave that way, and to kill literally about probably 75 million animals a day just in this country alone for food. And so there's an enormous momentum, and because people feel so bad about it, we feel such a acute sense of grief and pain that people just don't want to look at it, and that's, I think, the hardest part. So every week I'm giving lectures on this subject somewhere in the country, and from my point of view, it looks good from my little point of view, because I'm always hearing from people, I'm so glad I read your book. I've become a vegetarian. I've become a vegan. And I want to teach classes in this, and I want to spread it. And I hear, in my own little world, maybe a false illusion, but I'm getting lots of positive feedback from the people that I'm in contact with. So it looks, everyone I'm seeing, there's all a sense of people changing, and there is changes happening. And I am aware, I think, somewhat of statistically, that there are the percentage of vegetarians and vegans, I think, is slowly growing. All that being said, I think that it looks pretty dire, actually. I mean, the effects of the mentality of violence that is required, mandated by our food choices in terms of terrorism and war and environmental effects, the global warming and severe pollution, the devastation of the oceans, the devastation of the rainforests, the accumulation of more and more wealth in the hands of a ever smaller, tiny elite, and the controlling of people, and the whole irony involved, that the more we control and dominate animals, the more we end up creating a culture that controls and dominates people and future generations are getting more and more marginalized. So I also go to other countries quite a bit, into South America, and see how it's spreading to other countries, which is, I think, the most sobering part of it. So in a way, you're right. It looks like it's just a massively difficult thing, because no one seems to be able to address this, and the mass media, which is for the most part controlled, again, by the wealthy elite, so much of their advertising revenue comes from what I call in the book the military-industrial meat-medical media complex, which is, I think, really a huge complex. Requires a lot of animals to be killed, a lot of land to be used, a lot of sick people.
Well, you got a couple people. You got a couple people. You have a couple million people in the army,
right?
And we're killing millions of animals every day just to feed the army.
Right, right.
We ain't going to change that diet.
Right, exactly. Well, see, this is the thing. So, all I can say is perhaps there's something happening on a deeper level in our culture. I hope so. I hope that there's a change happening. Sometimes I have this feeling that it's just an intuitive feeling that it's happening. I guess it's sort of like if you were looking at a caterpillar, say, and it was just eating and eating and eating, and you could say this nothing that this caterpillar does but eat, and it's going to just eat up everything that there is to eat, and that's it. And then at one point, suddenly, with no basis in any of its history, it just stops, and it just turns its attention within, and it just transforms its whole energy and goes in a new direction. And I'm just basically praying that we humans have something within us like that, that we're right now, we're devastating this planet. We're going blindly headlong in a consumerist frenzy that's completely devastating our culture on every level. And unless we suddenly stop and reflect and transform our behavior, and it could happen like caterpillars do, and there are examples of this in nature, then it's clear that we won't leave much of an earth to our children.
Now, I've got an acquaintance who occasionally listens to the show and has suggested ideas. As a matter of fact, he's the one who turned me on to you, and he hasn't expressed it this way, but I will for him. I think what he seems to be saying is what might bring this to the tipping point is a revolution in our educational system. And the guy advocates humane education. And his thesis seems to be if we got people teaching humane education, if we got people teaching about a world peace diet, if we got people in schools in public schools explaining about eating for spiritual health and social harmony and the significance of veganism and vegetarianism.
Right.
If we got it into our grade schools, our high schools, our universities, that might bring about change, humane education.
Yeah.
It's something,
right,
though, that you don't touch on in your book.
Right. Well, the...
Except the book itself.
The book itself is, to me, is sort of a... It's the...
Humane education.
It's sort of like the view of what this education actually is what the book is. And I, of course, aim... it's not written for grade school or middle... that level. But it is... I think it is written for college-age people. I mean, someone who's, from university or college courses. And I really think... That's a great potential. Children are also, younger people are also, but the thing is, they don't have a lot of freedom in their situation, and they're still, in many ways, completely, modeling their parents. I mean, at a certain point,
Let me turn that around. That's all you got to do, is hammer a bunch of sixth graders, and tell them that it's a bad idea to eat meat. Right, and you'll have 200 parents storming the Bastille.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so, I think at the college level is probably. I mean, I would love to see, changes happening with children. But the thing is, children are like sponges, and they just soak up their culture. So if the parents don't change and the adults don't change, they will not change. Kids become like the adults. That's what they do. That's what it is in every culture. If you study anthropology, that's what happens. So. But when we get the young adults, then they kind of break free of that a little bit, and I think we have a window there where they can make their own meals, they can make their own decisions, and they still have the indoctrination is pretty thick, but maybe it's not quite as thick as it is when we get older, perhaps, or the willingness to change. Although I've seen people change at every age. My mother was probably in her 70s, and she became a vegan. So a lot of people do that. But I think, I basically advocate talking to everybody and anybody, that we can all change. But I think probably the younger people are easier to grasp the significance of this and actually change their behavior. So I think that's true.
I got to take a quick break. I want to continue this conversation. Will you stay with us?
Yes.
Okay. Folks, stick around. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Alan Eisenberg. This is the Alan Eisenberg Show. We're right here on WRJN, 8 a.m. 1400, News Talk for Racine and Kenosha. We're talking to Dr. Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. Personally, I think, just my experience, I think this is a hard sell, and it's ridiculous that it should be, I can appreciate the fact that you get a good reception when people know it in advance, who you are, what your theses are, and you really propose the cure for what ails humanity.
Right.
So
here it is.
It's ridiculous, yeah, that people are resistive to it. It really is ridiculous. And I know I'm getting people ticked off just by saying these things. Let's try to tackle a few of them because we've got 19 minutes left.
Okay.
Let's try to tackle a few of them. Mm-hmm. First of all, one of the best little items that you nail in your book is obesity. Now, why the heck should people be opposed to something as simple as your ideas if it could lick obesity. Why? Because people want to be fat. Let's face it. Okay.
Well,
okay. You have the dais again. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, obesity, what I say really in the book is that it's important for us as a culture and as human beings to look more deeply. You know, we have just been trained and we train ourselves to look at a very shallow level, and we try to solve things at a shallow level, and it doesn't work. We have to look to the underlying causes of why we have these dilemmas that we cannot solve. And a lot of it, I believe, is that we sow seeds and we reap the effects of those seeds, and the seeds are our actions. And so we force, for example, animals into conditions of chronic obesity. Animals are sold by the pound. They are raised, for food, and the people who are running these operations get paid for them by the pound.
So we fatten them up.
So, right, we give them special foods that are high in saturated, in fat and cholesterol, and we give them special hormones and drugs and other.
But it doesn't make too much difference to the people who do it, because they're fattening up to kill them.
Well, they're fattening them up to kill them, right. So they become very fat, very young, very quickly, and then they kill them. But we're basically sowing these seeds of making them as fat as possible, and then we reap that in ourselves. We find that obesity is just growing and growing and growing, and it's because, I think on a deep level, we're eating the bodies of these fattened animals, but we're also forcing others into obesity. The basic teachings and all the spiritual traditions, and I think the fundamental principles of the universe can be boiled down to a few basic things. One is, whatever I would most want for myself, I should give to others.
Uh-huh.
So if I want,
we're not living by the golden rule.
Right, exactly.
Unto others.
We're actually forcing these conditions on others. Like osteoporosis is another example. You know, we force these animals into severe osteoporosis, especially the female animals that are used for dairy products and eggs. We force them to overproduce. You know, these dairy cows, for example, at the most would give 25 pounds of milk a day. In the wild, for example, and only for probably 4 or 5 months, we give them, again, special feeds high in cholesterol and high in fat, and also give them special hormones like prolactin, progesterone, estrogen, oxytocin, and other hormones to force them to give much more milk, about 110 pounds of milk a day. So all that milk coming out of them just depletes their bodies of calcium and their bones of calcium, and so they become they have severe osteoporosis. By the time they're only 4 or 5 years old, they would normally live to be 25 years. At the age of only 4 or 5 years old, they're worn out because they've been kept pregnant and lactating. It's this brutal treatment. And this is even organic cows. It doesn't matter if it's organic dairy or not. And so they're dragged off to the slaughterhouse. Basically, all the downers that we hear about that are animals that can no longer walk, they're non-ambulatory when they get to the slaughterhouse, are dairy cows who have such severe osteoporosis that their bones just break under them, their legs break, and they have to be dragged onto the slaughterhouse floor. And the same thing is true of the chickens that produce our eggs. Again, they're pushed to overproduce with the special lighting schedules and feed and all that. So they give so many eggs that they have severe osteoporosis as well, and their bones just break very easily.
And they're inoculated. They're inoculated to death.
They're inoculated with a huge variety of drugs and hormones, exactly. And
we reap
osteoporosis in these animals and these females. And again, we have skyrocketing rates of osteoporosis and for ourselves. And it's all connected. I mean, the violence that we inflict on these animals, the drugs that we inflict on these animals, the fear that we inflict on these animals, the breakdown of their families, all of these things we find, again, reverberating into our human life. We've reaped these seeds, and we can't seem to make the connections. We've lost our intelligence, our cultural intelligence, at such a deep level that we don't make the connections, and we go on getting more and more sick, and then we have all these pharmaceutical corporations making billions of dollars from animals on all the drugs they sell to animals, and all the similar drugs they have to sell to humans, I mean, I just heard some, you know, just now, the drugs for colds, the drugs for depression, the drugs for all these things. We force these animals into these conditions, and we eat the products that come from them, which are very unhealthy for us. And so we lose, really, our clarity and our health.
You've got all of these fast food companies all over America,
right,
who are selling people literally by the ton, by the millions of tons of processed chicken. And the average person on the street does not, he doesn't have a clue, he or she, they don't have a clue,
right,
that when they're eating that chicken, they're eating not only a load of antibiotics, you're eating an antibiotic sandwich. It has no legitimate food value, none. None. You might as well, if you're not going to read the damn book, eat the book. You might as well put a little mustard on your book and just eat the damn book, because that's how much food value you're getting when you eat a chicken sandwich. You're eating 6-8 ounces of antibiotics and toxins.
It's very toxic. Yeah,
give me a break.
The toxins. It's true. It's very toxic, and it's really the driving force behind the massive profits of the medical pharmaceutical complex.
I think you make a mistake when you bang them for that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Money drives the machine.
Sure, yeah.
Okay? If Tuttle and Eisenberg could just figure out a way to get the money machine behind the vegan diet and the vegetarian diet, That's we need a different paradigm.
We need a different paradigm.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think the basic welfare of all of us would be improved, and just, you know, it would be a whole different culture. We
Tuttle and Eisenberg's Kentucky Fried Asparagus.
Right. How about that?
Yep.
Yeah. And we'd have so much more land left over. People wouldn't have to work 8 hours a day. You know, it would be a different, a whole different way of being on this earth. But it does come back to questioning the assumptions of our culture. That's one of the main themes in the book. It's a question. I call it leaving home. Questioning the underlying assumptions of our culture, and that's the foundation for progress, for evolution, for change, for real positive transformation.
Now tell me about the myth of evil.
The myth of evil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's something I talk about in the book. And the basic idea, I think, is that when we eat animal foods, we do something that we really do not feel good about. However, we cover it up. And that causes what Carl Jung called a shadow. The shadow is what we are, but which we, at a deep level, deny being. So we say, oh, we're good, kind, caring people who just like having a good steak every night, or good some chicken and bacon and so forth. And so, but then we project that shadow, so we see, but there's evil people out there, and they're cruel and they're violent, and we have to make a lot of weapons to protect ourselves against them and maybe attack them for their cruelty. And so we project a shadow, which is really, in many ways, our own unfaced violence and aggression. And so we create a whole system. I think it's important, you know, it's hard, as you said earlier, to give these ideas just in a nutshell without the background of the whole rest of the book that I talked about.
Here's the nutshell. We have found the enemy, and it is us.
Right, it is us. And but the culture for the last 10,000 years has been, you know, basically generating this kind of a shadow, and we're in that culture. I talk about in the book how the last revolution we had was 10,000 years ago, and it's time for another, you know, major change. And it's our own violence coming back to us. The evil that we see in the world, you know, in others, in many ways, is our own violence projected. The animals cannot retaliate against us. You know, other human beings can, but the animals can't. So our violence towards them retaliates against us. It's our violence itself retaliates against us, and a lot of it, you know, it retaliates as disease, as stress, as conflict in our relationships, as a sense of unhappiness and despair. If we want to really be joyful, happy, free, creative, you know, then we're called to treat others well. You know, all other beings that can feel. And as we do that, we'll find our lives just getting so much happier. I mean, the level of happiness and joy and peace just goes higher and higher and higher the more we're kind and loving to other living beings, and the more we're aware of the ripples that go out from our lives and take responsibility for those and make sure that every, you know, interaction we're having is to be a blessing rather than a curse to others, then we'll find that we're really living while we're here, and we become part of the solution to the to these problems rather than blaming others. So it's really something we can all do. We can all make a change.
It's like we live by, we really do, 99% of us live by a code of arrogance. We don't we don't own this place.
Right.
We share this earth.
Right.
We don't own it. We share it.
Exactly. And we and there's this underlying assumption that might makes right. You know, we have the power. We can steal the land from these other living beings. We can enslave them. We can force them into extinction. We can take away their habitat. We can take away their dignity. We can completely devastate them. And that somehow we can go on and be happy and be successful and be and so forth. And it will never happen. We are, we make ourselves more and more miserable as we harm others. So we treat them like they don't matter. We don't show them respect. And the basic teaching is we'll never have any self-respect, any authentic self-respect, as long as we can't respect others. And so we have to stop eating animal foods. We have to see that, change that behavior, and understand why it's so important to be kind to other living beings. And then we'll find that we can actually grow spiritually, that spiritual maturity is only possible in the context of kindness to others. Otherwise, it's a joke. It makes no sense. We, you know, these beings, how can we say they don't matter? How can we say it's just a chicken? People said that about, you know, women, about black people, whatever. They said they don't matter. We know that they matter. To them, their interests are just as important to them as mine are to me. We have to learn to get outside of our own arrogance, like you said, and look with eyes of loving kindness and respect to others.
You know, if you had to draw a comparison, what's a more compelling argument? Not that arguing with anybody gets you anywhere, but what's a more compelling argument? The spiritual and ideological argument or the health argument?
Good question. I think, you know, for me, I think especially for young people, the ideological argument is the best. You know, that's why I became a vegan, you know, back 30 years ago. I didn't, you know, it wasn't for my health. I was young and healthy, and, you know, I didn't, you know, but I, when I saw what we did to animals, and that, you know, and I saw that I didn't need to eat animals, even though I was raised in a family that ate massive amounts of animal foods, I just got it, and I've never eaten them since, and it's been the greatest blessing in my entire life. So I think that is the motivation that won't let you down. You know, I think people who become a vegetarian, for example, if you're a vegetarian, you're still eating dairy products, and dairy products are so extremely toxic that you very often don't feel any better. And
now, slow down.
In there too.
Slow down. Back up on that one.
All right.
I was going to get to it anyway. It was on my list of topics.
Uh-huh.
The toxicity of dairy. Go ahead.
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, it's almost, I mean, it really is, I think, probably just as toxic or maybe more toxic than the flesh of animals, mainly because we are not cows. You know, we are not equipped to handle the basic protein in milk, which is casein. We don't have renin in our stomachs. We cannot handle this protein. Whether you're lactose intolerant or not, doesn't matter. Casein is a molecule that we cannot break down, and so a lot of researchers have said that 80 to 90% of doctor's office visits are due directly to milk proteins because they cause this whole laundry list of things we suffer with, the mucus, the arthritis, kidney disease, the problems with colic, so many things that children have, sore throats and earaches and runny noses and all these things, and allergies, and there's just a huge long list of things that people attribute dairy products to, and I talk about that in the book, but also the suffering of these animals. You know, and also the IGF-1 growth factor, which has been shown to be one of the main driving forces behind breast cancer and prostate cancer. People knew in the old days that if a woman was angry or upset, that her milk would very often not be very good for the baby to drink. It would sometimes make the baby sick. Think about these poor cows are going through. I mean, they're just having their babies stolen. They're being treated horribly. They're in fear and terror and panic all the time because of the being shocked very often by the milking machines. I mean, the milking machines are hard on them, and they're pushed to give so much milk that their udders are very often dragging in their own excrement and so forth. So there's a lot of suffering on the dairy, and we're eating the very energy of that, the essence of that suffering. The depression, you know, I mean, all these sales of drugs for depression, and you think of all these cows, there's so much depression in the milk, and cheese really concentrates that. It takes 20 or 30 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese. So just think of the amount of casein and fat and misery in these products. And then we see that Americans eating so much of this and all of the toxins on the grains. And if you just knew what these cows eat, you know, they feed them foods that, you know, they feed them a lot of flesh in order to make them give more milk. So they feed them
They put manure in the feed.
Right. They feed, yeah, exactly. They put chicken manure in. They put fish. They put the rendering house byproducts, dead cows, dead animals, dead cats and dogs, roadkill. Even dead cows were always put in, even their own babies typically, but now they don't do that anymore because of mad cow disease, supposedly. But these are the things we're eating, and I think the average person has no idea, and if we knew, we would never feed these things to our loved ones or eat them ourselves.
Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. God bless you, man. Thank you for being with us tonight.
All right.
I really appreciate it.
It's been great.
We want to catch you next time you get back this way.
Okay.
Thank you so
Thanks
much.
A lot, Al. Yep.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Now. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us. We'll be back next week with another edition of The Alan Eisenberg Show. Good night.